Hey everyone, and welcome to Hero's Journey Physio Fitness. Our mission is guiding people to reclaim their health and become self-reliant. I'm your host, Dr. Cameron Hoag, and joining me is my co-host, Anibal Rios.
All right, guys, we're going live in 3, 2, 1. Welcome to another episode of Hero's Journey. It's been quite a while since you've heard from me and Cam. Yeah, we've been in hiatus, but we're back, and we won't tell you where we've been. That's top secret. But what we're doing different now, guys, is we're trying to transition more to interview style. So we're trying to get guests on, trying to get different backgrounds, whether it's physical therapy, whether it's MDs, anything, training, health and fitness related. So if you think of anyone, send them our way. We'll love to have them on the podcast. So Cam, who do we have today?
All right, everybody, we have Dr. Micah Easterling, and I'm going to give you just a little bit of background. Yeah, there he is right there. I'm going to give you a little background, and then we'll kind of get into a very exciting episode here. So Dr. Easterling hails from North Texas, where he attended college at the University of Texas at Dallas, having a perfectly unremarkable D3 baseball career. After undergrad, Micah followed his mother's footsteps, going to physical therapy school at Harding University with me from 2016 to 2019. After PT school with me, Micah was picked to commission into the U.S. Air Force as a captain and physical therapist. After graduating officer training school at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama, Micah was stationed at Kirtland AFB in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where he met and married his wife and worked in a variety of capacities. Deployed in 2022 to Kuwait, working primarily with pilots, EOD bomb techs, Air Force special operators. Upon returning to the U.S., Micah and his family moved to Abilene, Texas, where he serves as an embedded PT at Dias AFB. Micah holds certifications in dry needling, battlefield acupuncture, and is a board-certified orthopedic clinical specialist. Micah was recently promoted to major and is expecting the birth of his first child any day from now. Micah, thanks so much for being on, my friend.
Good to see y'all again.
I just want to set the ground rules here that if she runs in and says, you need to take me to the hospital, my water broke, you have to finish this podcast, okay? Is she aware of that?
I would love to take her to the hospital. We're taking her to a midwife birthing center thing. And so if her water breaks right now, I would love to take her to the hospital, but I will finish the podcast first.
Thank you. She can just be in the background or something.
Yeah, priority is important, you know?
Yeah.
So do you prefer major or doctor or just Dr. Major?
I'm Micah. Yeah. Micah's fine. The medical people don't call me doctor and the military people don't call me major. So I go by my first name half the time anyway. So it's all good.
That's good.
Yeah. All right, Micah. Well, how did you even get into the military and like the physical therapy side of things? Give us a little background on that.
So my mom is a PT. My aunt is a PT. My grandmother was an OT. And then my brother and my cousin are PTs. But growing up, listening to my mom and my aunt talk about people that they worked with, they went to school at Texas State, which is right next to one of the big Air Force installations in San Antonio. And they would work with people that were PTs coming out of the military. And they just would say how cool that was and that they thought they were really good clinicians. And so I already kind of had it on my radar when I went to Harding. And then when I was there, you know, I met with Dr. Azell. So Dr. Azell was our pathophys.
Pharmacology.
And then
imaging. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was a retired Navy flight surgeon. Which the fact that he ever wrote me a letter of recommendation for the military is amazing. Cause do you remember?
It's shocking.
In our first week of PT school, I decided I was going to change my ways and sit on the front row. Well, I fell asleep and I knocked over an entire Yeti full of coffee in the middle of the first week of lecture. He was not too impressed, but, got to talk to Dr. Azell about military medicine, and in his very, you know, Northwest Arkansas accent, he said, "You like boats?" I said, "No, sir, I hate boats." He goes, "All right, well, you won't make it in the Army, so here's the Air Force recruiter."
I forgot about his accent.
I love Dr. Azell. I don't know what he's doing, but I know he still says diabetes, and that makes my heart warm.
Yeah. For everybody listening, our old professor never said diabetes. He said diabetes, but he's also the smartest person we probably have met in a long time, so he can say whatever he wants.
Absolutely brilliant. He was great. So I contacted the recruiter probably at the start of our third year of PT school. And it's very competitive to get picked up. And most people that get selected to commission, so it's called direct commissioning, most of them have been out of school for 5 or 6 years. Most of them are already board certified. Most of them are already dry needling certified. And also, before I get too much into this, nothing I say is reflective of the DOD or the United States Air Force or anything like that. This is just me talking out of my mind.
This is not major or doctor. This is just Micah.
This is just me. So please don't contact my chain of command. But it used to be kind of a running joke that people would, like, clinicians would get divorced and then run away and join the Air Force. I mean, it was kind of like their second career. I haven't found that to be true too much of the time, but, so I applied just cause I knew it's probably going to take 2 or 3 times to get in. And so did my rotations, and it's kind of scary. Like when you get through PT school and you realize you're going to be super in debt and you get on rotations, and then you meet PTs that like don't like their job. And so I kind of had, I'm like, what is this for? I applied to the Air Force right before I took the boards. Found out that I got waitlisted, which was pretty good for your first try. Didn't know where I was on the waitlist or anything like that, but basically through the interview process, I basically said, I am unmolded clay. If you pick me up, you can teach me to be whatever you want.
Sculpt me.
Exactly. Sculpt me.
Paint me like one of your French girls.
Yes, exactly. So passed the boards. I was already working on a temporary license in downtown Dallas. I thought I was going to be like the, like Ted Mosby from How I Met Your Mother, like just, living in downtown Dallas, meeting interesting people, living like the metropolitan life. I hated it. I hated it so much. And so I worked in a civilian practice in Dallas for about, I think I got my permanent license, and then 2 weeks later I found out that I got picked up off the wait list. But the kicker was, they said, hey, I don't know where you're going. I don't know where you're going to move to. I don't know when you're going, but I need you to say yes. Or if you can't say yes without knowing where you're going, you can't take it. And so I said yes. About 2 weeks later, found out I was going to Albuquerque. Had never been to Albuquerque. And that was July. By October, I was in Maxwell, in Alabama for officer training school. That's how I got into the military, PT side. Yeah,
that's awesome, man. So there are some different roles of physical therapist in the military versus, as you're kind of saying, civilian physical therapist. Do you mind kind of diving into that and letting us know more of what that means?
Yeah. And depending on where you're in your career and what your interests are and what your skills are, you can kind of take it a lot of different ways. Every Air Force PT is, they say you're an officer first. A lot of times you might not be in a super clinical role. You could be, in one of these special positions, or you could be just starting out, but, you're supposed to be an officer first. And so leadership comes onto you a little bit quicker than it would on the outside. I was the equivalent of a clinic director the first day I entered the Air Force, and they said, hey, this is your clinic. Don't burn it to the ground. Which is a lot easier when you don't have to worry about keeping the lights on or making a profit. So thank you, taxpayer. But You can stay clinical and you can stay in the hospital. We call it the MTF, the military treatment facility. And that's traditional outpatient ortho.
Yeah.
The nice thing, most of the time it's a nice thing, is most PT clinics in the military are active duty only. And so your population that you're going to treat is typically 18 to 45. And when you're 18 to 45, like, that takes out a lot of comorbidities. People heal faster. You can do spinal manipulations. You can dry needle everyone. You don't have to worry if they're going to stroke out on your table. So it opens up a lot of things. But then, you know, I started moonlighting at a clinic in town here, try to make some extra baby money. And I treated my first octogenarian since PT school. And I'm like, what do I do with this person? And so you can get into bad habits just like you can on the outside. So that's one role, working in the clinic, supervising. The Air Force has it's kind of like a PTA equivalent called a 4J. So they're enlisted. They go to kind of an accelerated PTA school. And then later they can test for their actual license. And just doing the outpatient ortho thing. The nice thing is our caseload is never really that bad at the most, unless you're deployed. You're seeing 8 to 15 patients a day. Where on the outside, you can be double booked and you can, you know, see 20 pretty easily.
Yeah.
But it's just a little bit different style of practice, and it's different when you realize that your customer isn't just the patient, that your customer is also the Air Force. And so it adds a little bit of an interesting dynamic to it.
Yeah.
So Micah, two questions for you. So you mentioned earlier that there's a difference between what you can do when you are deployed versus what you can do when you're back home in the States. Can you explain that a little bit? And then also, do you find a difference with like compliance, meaning that they're doing their exercise, doing all the things that you're prescribing to them?
Mm-hmm. So as far as the difference, what you can do in the States and what you can do when you're deployed. So when you're in the States, and this might come as a surprise, but all the hospitals that you're treating out of, just like a civilian hospital, they have to be compliant with the same agencies. So we still do DJC inspections. We still do infection control, and we're still held to that same standard. We don't want to, you're in the military, you don't need to be held to the civilian standard, because then everyone's going to want to go out to the normal hospital and not the military hospital, right? And so there's just rules. And there, every rule is there for a purpose. But as far as, hey, you need a sink in your clinic, or you can't treat outside of the hospital, or something like that. Pretty standard rules. Or like in Texas, or where I'm at right now, you know, we're allowed to order MRIs and PET scans and CAT scans and stuff like that. But the city that I'm in, the imaging centers won't take a referral from a physical therapist. So that's like a state rule, not a federal rule. When you're deployed, the mission is different. And so, if you can do it safely, effectively, and ethically, a lot of the times, you don't have to worry about, are we going to get inspected? You're not in a hospital. You're in a deployed setting. And so a lot of the red tape gets stripped away. For instance, like I've dry needled someone in the back of a Humvee.
We gave a little extra twitches in there, you know?
Yeah. We set up a manipulation table in an armory and just had a line of people. And so there's just different rules when you're deployed, because I was deployed in a friendly country in peacetime. I was in Kuwait, and anybody that listens to you that is a veteran or anything like that, they're going to say Air Force officer in Kuwait. And they're going to call me a POG, a person other than grunt. or a RIMP, which is a rear echelon. Yeah, the people that know.
Yeah,
it's a little cushy, but you still have the same tempo and a little bit of this is going out a little bit more, but the job when you're deployed isn't actually to get them necessarily better. Like you want them to get better, but your job is, can you keep them in country? If you can keep them in country, then you don't have to take somebody from back home, rip them away from their family on short notice and bring them to the middle of the desert. Or you're probably never getting that body back. And so you don't have to worry about causing your military police to be down a man for the next 6 months. Right. And so it's kind of like it's more sports medicine than it is rehab. So it's just different. There's just different rules and different expectations of what you can do stateside versus when you're deployed.
That sounds super interesting. I mean, just saying the whole manipulation line, we joke about that in the clinic of like, just line them up and let me just tear right through them and stuff. But obviously you can't do that.
Yeah.
It's at least in the setting that I'm in.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that's the nice thing is when you're deployed, a lot of the, oh man, I really wish I could do that, but I just can't. No one would ever sign off on that. That's kind of stripped away. And then when you come back from deployment, and you're like, what do you mean I can't take my table and my go bag and go to the hangar and just do my job? You realize that you can safely and effectively do your job. It kind of shocks some people. Like, what do you mean you treated in the break room or in the conference room? It's like, yeah, and no one died. Everything was fine. People got better. Everyone loved it. And so you mentioned you talk to cash pay people or stuff like that. Like, it's a real thing because people still get better and you can do your job safely and effectively.
That's awesome, man. So side note here, do physical therapists in the military have to still do like PT testing, physical training testing and meet those standards for like the push-ups and mile run and BMI and all that kind of stuff or no?
Yes. Caveat. Again, Mike, not speaking for the military at large. So the Air Force has a different culture than other branches. The jokes, there's some truth to it. They call us the Chair Force.
The Chair Force.
It was the newest branch, right? So the Air Force came out of the Army. It's only been around since 1947. The Army can trace its roots back to, you know, the Continental Militias. The Marine Corps, I think, can trace it back further than that. And then the Navy's tradition goes back, you know, if you go to England, like to the 1400s. Ours started in 1947. And because you have to have the highest scores, this isn't the real, like the full reason, but people in the Air Force tend to have higher test scores, there's more college credits in the enlisted force. It's more of a corporate environment and less of a military environment sometimes.
Gotcha.
And so, yes, we do PT testing. We do body mass testing. Out of all the branches, it has the strictest height and weight requirement to enter. You remember me in PT school, when I started, I was probably 260. By the time I was done, I was probably like 225, 230.
Yeah.
To be accepted into the Air Force, I had to be 197 pounds. And so I crash dieted. I cut water like a wrestler. And my scale was off. And so when I showed up at MEPS, which is kind of the medical check you have to do to be able to enter, I was actually 185 pounds and I didn't have enough fluid in me to provide a urine sample. and I was so dehydrated, I failed the heart rate test. And so I laid down on a cold floor in the bathroom till I could like calm down. So people like, and the reason being that they have those tight standards is they want to make pilots, right? And so they want smaller people. Yeah. But they never test you again. Like they don't say like, all right, you're 6 foot, you have to stay below 250 pounds or whatever. They're starting to do a body mass index type of thing. But it's not fully integrated. And our PT test is not difficult. It's just not difficult.
What is it?
Mm-hmm. So it changes every once in a while. It just changed. So now it's a mile and a half run, which it breaks down by age. But just for reference, if you're in the lowest age range, so like 18 to 25 or something like that, I think you need to be below like a 12-minute mile and a half. I could be wrong about that, but for me in the 30 to 35, like I got to be below a 14. So that's not super fast, right?
Right.
You can run, there's a shuttle run that you can do, and then it's a push up in a minute, sit up in a minute, or there's some options, like a hand release push up or a reverse crunch or something like that. It's not to the point like the Marine Corps PT test or the Army PT test, which is a lot more functional. They have a deadlift. They have a drag and a carry. It's not as functional as that. And I hope that one day it will be.
Yeah.
But yes, Air Force PTs are held to the same physical and medical standards, as the rest of the Air Force. We're a part of the rest of the Air Force. Sometimes we forget that. But we are supposed to be held to the same standard.
Gotcha. Good stuff, man. Good stuff.
Yeah. As far as the other domains that PTs operate in the military, and I can only speak for the Air Force, but the other branches are similar. You can be in kind of a job that I'm in now, which is kind of more of a preventative model. So I'm on part of a team called the Operational Support Team. And it's myself, a clinical psychologist, a strength coach, and then a team specialist, which is kind of your admin, but typically they're an athletic trainer or, someone in like the health and fitness domain. And we go unit by unit and we try to embed with them for 3 or 4 months and just improve the unit however we can. And so it's not as much patient care, but it's more root causes and injury prevention, and fitness, like trying to instill a fitness culture, into the Air Force that's lacking compared to other branches. And then like the rest of the world, the military is in a mental health crisis. And so trying to get a mental health provider out of the medical group into the squadron to kind of break that stigma, and make access a little bit easier. So that's what I've been doing for a couple of years. And I love it. It's great. You can, be a, we call them SMEs, subject matter experts, but you can be embedded in a specific unit. Those are typically in either fighter squadrons, or in Air Force Special Operations. And basically you're their team doc, you're their team PT. And those are very highly competitive jobs, and they're really, really cool jobs. They are working with the tip of the spear, and you don't really have to deal with a lot of the necessarily the Air Force side. You're there to be a specialist and an expert and to keep these guys going. These guys and gals now that are not superheroes, they're just normal guys. You'll see some people that look like G.I. Joe, and you'll see some people that look like they can't walk and chew gum at the same time. or some of the pilots that are some of the most insane, smartest people or that do the craziest job in the world. And then you ask them to do a squat and it looks like they just got hit with a taser. I think I grew up thinking that people in the military were all good athletes, were all in shape. And they're not. Like they're just not like, I feel like most of them are just guys and gals that maybe are fitter than your average person. But I mean, military still has obesity. Military still has people that are not fit, that don't know how to work out. It happens, you know, we're not really any different than the rest of the population. But you can be a SME or an embedded, a full-time embedded PT in one of those cool high-speed units. You can get into academia. There's fellowships and residencies through the military. I applied nice. For one now. But you can also be a professor, either at the Air Force Academy. You can teach in like the professional military education piece, or at the Army PT school in San Antonio. So, and then I guess the last one is you can get into research. There's some of us that just do research, and a lot of the best research, specifically in the PT realm, comes out of the military because we kind of have a captive population. And so a lot of kind of landmark studies, especially in the realms of manual therapy, have come out of the military. So there's other pathways. Leadership's a big one as far as like getting into hospital administration or stuff like that. But basically you never get bored, because if you do, you can just kind of find a different vector for your career.
That's legit, man. I didn't know all that stuff.
It's fun. I like it.
No, that is, I guess, Micah. So I guess tell us a little bit about the military direct access PT. I guess more a little bit about that, what that entails.
So physical therapy as a profession actually came out of the military, mainly out of the nursing corps in the Army in World War II. It's one of the first wars where you had tons of amputees, because before, if you got your leg blown off, you just didn't come home. But advances in medicine it's the truth. You know, in World War I, they didn't have tourniquets. They didn't understand, like, oh, if someone's leg gets blown off, we maybe should stop the bleeding. They just had the chaplain come over and say, all right, it's been good. But in World War II, the medicine changed. It actually started to become kind of advanced. And so people were surviving injuries that in the past never survived. And then they would come home and they'd have to, like, all right, I was a bus driver at home and now I don't have an arm. What am I supposed to do? Or I got blown up, or my leg doesn't work like it used to. So the Army was one of the first ones that recognized, like, oh, we need to figure out how to rehab people. And so PT kind of came out of the nursing career field, in World War II. And I can't exactly remember when PTs became its own thing in the military. But as far as direct access, in the PT world, that's kind of the buzzword, and that's the hope, is that, hey, we're totally independent. We don't need to rely on doctors or referral sources or stuff like that. Well, the military's been doing that since the 70s.
Let's go, baby.
And we've been fine. Everything's been fine. The sky's not falling.
You've dry needled someone in the back of a Humvee. You guys are fine.
Humvee wasn't moving. Humvee was not moving.
We'll tell people it was moving. Don't worry.
But it was moving, everybody.
Yeah. But so APTA this past year came out with it was like a study basically saying the military is supporting using PTs as direct access primary care. And it was this big thing, like, oh, wow, the military's doing it. It really wasn't anything new. We've been doing it since the 70s. But what the military started to do some places is treat PTs as primary care providers, because most of what comes to the medical group, people come, my back hurts, my chest hurts, my shoulder hurts. Well, they'll have them see a PT first and see, all right, is this musculoskeletal? If it's musculoskeletal, you're mine. Just come with me. Don't go to the PA or the PCM, or if it's not, like, okay, this is what I think it is, and hand it off to the medical side of the house. And they've been having pretty good results with that. But
that's legit.
Yeah, yeah. What they've found is if you do direct access PT, then you lose less man hours, which squadron commanders love, because their people aren't going off base or waiting for 2 weeks to get a referral and then the injury getting worse. You just go to the clinic and you get treated. So it's good from that standpoint, but also the military as a whole treats PTs like experts in their field. And, you know, the average, and this might change program to program, but the average PA, the average MD, the average DO, they get, I think we were told in PT school, like 4 or 5 weeks of musculoskeletal care, unless you go down the orthopedic or the sports medicine track.
Right.
That's all we do for 3 years. And so it's nice that, you know, Cam, I'm sure you've talked to a doctor from time to time and you feel a little talked down to, or you feel like you're a little bit of a second class provider. The military doesn't really do that. They treat you like you're a specialist in your field. And they allow you to operate to the full extent of your education. Now that comes with a lot of extra responsibility, because you don't have the safety net of, well, the doctor provided, you know, referred them to me. They must be appropriate to be in my office. They must be cardiovascularly stable. They must, this must actually be musculoskeletal, that I don't have to screen for outside stuff. And so you have to, your screening needs to be on point. Your knowledge of, hey, this person's on this medication, and that could be interacting with something, or could be presenting as something like that. Stuff that we're taught in school, but then you never really go out and practice that much.
And then if you don't use it, you lose it. You know?
Yeah, exactly. And then you have to be prepared if something goes bad. Especially because a lot of our clinics do like pure walk-ins. Like, since we don't have to worry about charging them, hey, from 7 to 10 Monday and Wednesday, if you're hurt, just show up and we'll treat you. You're probably the first provider these people have seen. And so you don't know, is it a compound fracture? Is it a, is the person having a heart attack thinking they're having shoulder pain?
Right.
The first patient I ever saw in the military was someone that ruptured their Achilles 15 minutes before. And I got to I got to watch it roll up.
That's fresh right there, my friend.
Yeah. And so it's, you know, when we talk about, hey, we want direct access, like, yes, we do want direct access. But I think as a profession on the whole, we got to step our game up a little bit. If you want it, you have to be able to do it responsibly. And so that means not pencil whipping your screening or your neuro screen or your special tests. Like, you got to make sure they're actually appropriate for you, you know? But direct access in the military works. It takes a lot of the workload off of the PAs and the MDs, and it gets people better faster. Right now our manning is not great, and so we're referring a lot of people off base. And if we keep someone in house, we're getting them back to their unit and off of profile about 3 weeks faster than if they go off base. And then there's a little bit of secondary gain, because that off base clinic is trying to make a profit.
Right.
And so, hey, I want, you're authorized for, you know, 15 visits. You're going to be seen for 15 visits, and who knows, maybe I'll send in for a re-auth, because I want to make money.
Right.
Whereas our goal is, how fast can I get you back to good? And so it's just a different mindset.
So kind of on the same lines of that, I mean, it's direct access, but also, some of these advanced privileges that physical therapists get in the military. Do you mind kind of letting the listeners know what some of these advanced privileges are? And then along that same vein, do you think every PT, civilian or non-civilian, PT should have them?
Yeah. So, military calls them advanced privileges or expanded privileges. And the point behind giving them is, hey, PT school education and PT school practice act in most states don't match up, where now in PT schools, you're taught a decent amount about imaging. You're taught a decent amount about medications, pathophysiology, stuff like that. And there's not a line of people trying to join the military. If you watch the news, like we're in a little bit of a recruiting crisis, not necessarily for PTs, but for doctors for sure. And so they're trying to, how can we do the most with a finite resource? And also if you're deployed, you're not in a hospital, you're probably in a tent and you might be by yourself. So trying to get the most out of PTs. And so, one, there's a couple advanced privileges that all PTs are required to get. And then there's some that if you get a little bit of extra training and you get someone to sign off that you're allowed to do. But, the main one is imaging. So all Air Force PTs, for the most part, all medical hospitals have their own x-ray unit. And so we are allowed to order x-rays. The crazy thing is children's book, if you give a mouse a cookie or something like that.
Love that book.
Yeah, it's a classic. Well, if you give PTs imaging privileges, they will order less images than anybody in the building because they know that what a fracture looks like for the most part, or they'll know when an x-ray is actually warranted. If you give them MRI privileges, they will continue to order the least amount of MRIs in the entire building because they know I only want to order an MRI if I think this person needs surgery and I know I can get this person better. And so I've been in for 5 years, probably ordered 15 MRIs. Doesn't happen. Wow. Doesn't happen.
Yeah. But that makes sense though, because we are trained to identify what the injury or the lesion might be. And then the MRI is like the, if they get one, is like proving that they have it. The MRI never doesn't always show exactly why they're having the pain.
Yeah.
But if it lines up with what kind of a physical therapy diagnosis is, then you can be like 100% sure.
Right.
But a lot of the times people come in with that MRI saying they got a bulging disc or whatever. And we know it's actually, their pain isn't from a bulging disc. Mm-hmm. It's from whatever it might be. And, but in their mind, they've got it being a bulging disc, but we treat them and they get better. And it's like, well, I guess it wasn't my disc.
Right. And so let's say we live in the world where PTs get imaging privileges on the outside. If you use it responsibly, then if the patient comes to you without an image, without an MRI, without saying that I am a bulging disc, and then the PT gets to decide whether or not to send that image out, then that's a good use of the tool of, hey, I think this person needs this. I'm going to use this as a tool. That's responsibly using it. What's not responsibly using it is PTs get imaging privileges and they're trying to keep the lights on in their clinic and they know they can get reimbursed really well for an MRI. Then we're just as bad as everyone else.
Right. You know? Especially if it's in-house.
Right. And then you're not, I mean, the power of a diagnosis is real, and people will cling to their diagnosis like very, very tightly. So you know, I've had people that don't have ridiculous back pain, that just have normal musculoskeletal back pain, but they got an MRI and they showed a bulging disc. And when they get mad at me, when I tell them, like, I think you're fine. I think you're just a aircraft maintenance, you know, technician. And you have a tough job and we just need to work on some core stability and some flexibility, and they'll kind of argue with you. So I think, I mean, it's a good tool to have, but it can be abused if you're looking for the financial gain, which is kind of nice looking at the military in that there's not a financial gain from the provider standpoint.
Yeah.
I'm just giving you, if I think you need it, you're not paying for it, so I'll do it. But if I don't think and I'm not just going to give it to you type of thing.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Military is a good environment to have that in because, again, technically you're saving the military money, right? If you don't order the MRI.
Right.
Right. And then the patient isn't paying out of pocket for it or through their insurance because they're in the military. The military pays for it.
Right. And so it's not a perfect experiment. There's still secondary gain in the military. Like, I don't want to take my PT test. I don't want to deploy. I'm going to retire in 6 months and I want a good disability rating. That's a big one. And so sometimes you almost have to play the workman's comp kind of game.
Yeah.
But it can be a useful thought experiment for like, what if money wasn't in the picture, you know?
Yeah.
So that's imaging. And I think at least x-rays, I think every PT should have the ability to do an x-ray.
Yeah.
And I think if PTs were the primary people ordering x-rays, then the total amount of x-rays that would actually be ordered are much, much less. So that's one of them. Some of the other ones, like all PTs in the military, or at least in the Air Force, we have to be dry needling certified. You have to be dry needling certified to be able to deploy, and to be considered like a senior clinician. So we've done that. Most Air Force PTs are certified in something called battlefield acupuncture.
Yeah, what is that?
It's kind of voodoo.
Did you say voodoo?
Yeah. So you remember,
I like voodoo.
You remember Dr. Odom talking about acupressure?
Yes.
Okay. So it's an acupuncturist. If you're listening, do not come at me.
The military is what he's saying. That's who sent him.
I'm not trying to steal your thunder. I'm not an acupuncturist. I do not claim to be an acupuncturist. BFA is a very localized use of needles that go into the ear. And they're semi-permanent needles. It can only be used in a military setting. So we're not stealing any business from acupuncturists or anything like that. Don't even want to open that can of potatoes. But basically the thought process is the same nerves that carry pain also have side branches that innervate parts of the ear. And so, there's a particular pattern. You put these little, they're called ASP needles, ASP, in specific.
I think you just said ass needles.
I know. That's what I spelled it.
Put some ass in that ear.
Yeah. Don't do that. And it has a really good pain response. It's not specific. It's not like, oh, I'm going to put this in the knee spot. But I'd say about 80% of people that I do it on have a pretty instantaneous pain reduction without popping.
Wow.
And within, you can do it within 2 or 3 minutes.
Wow.
And so it's pretty powerful. And I was not a believer. I didn't think it was, I got trained in it and then I never used it. And then when I was deployed, I ran out of 40s and 50s. And I was like, all right, well, I can't dry needle. So I'm going to start like doing some BFA to try to help some people's pain, see if they can stay in country. And it works really well.
And now you're a believer.
And now I'm a believer. Yeah. I mean, I've done it on people for TMJ pain, people that needed a root canal. It's pretty powerful. And so like there is something to Eastern style medicine. I don't know what it is.
Voodoo.
But a lot of us are trained in it. Which is helpful for if you're a pilot, then you can't, there's like a very strict list of what you can and can't take for pain. If you wear a gun for your job, there's a very strict list of what you can do for pain.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense.
To be able to keep your gun. But if you use one of these needles for pain, it's not hallucinogenic, it's not a sedative. And so a lot of times they're able to do that. So that's pretty cool.
That's really cool, man.
We're starting to learn how to do point of care ultrasound, musculoskeletal ultrasound. We're not really spun up on it yet, but the thought process of being able to hold a handheld unit and be able to tell, did this person just tear their Achilles?
Yeah.
Or is it just a pull?
That would be great for the rotator cuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's people out there that are doing it. There's a board certification for, I don't know if it's specifically for PTs, but in musculoskeletal ultrasound, only like 5 or 6 people have it. But they're going to start trying to get us to train up on that. It's not an advanced privilege, but just something that you'll find is every PT loves to crack. We love manipulations, which in our PT school, we didn't learn a single grade 5.
Not a single one.
The entire time, which is pretty rare, I'm finding out. when I joined the military, I knew zero manipulations. And on my first day, my boss gave me a challenge coin, which was like the PT challenge coin. And it says, what does it say? Something to the effect of like, it was a bottle opener coin. And it says, grade five manips only, or break glass in case of grade five manip. Like, we love to crack. So you have some very skilled manual therapists in the military. But then there's some cool ones. Like, you can, if you have someone that's willing to teach you and willing to sign off and say, I trained this person, they're competent. Some people do joint injections. Some people do joint aspirations.
Just the wild, wild west out there, man.
It's not common, but in certain jobs, it's really, really useful. And in deployed settings, it's really, really useful. So for example, we're allowed very, very limited, prescribing authority. It's like some NSAIDs, some muscle relaxers, and a couple other things. But I've done it maybe twice, not deployed, because why? Like, there's people that know that better than me.
Right.
But when you're deployed, you might be it. And so they try to get you trained up on this stuff and let you do it at home so you stay relevant in it, in case, hey, this person is commanding this unit and they just pulled their hamstring playing rugby and they're going into Iraq tomorrow. Not that that ever happened.
Of course not.
This person has to go. Let's make them as competent as humanly possible. So,
yeah.
I don't think everyone should have advanced privileges. There's some PTs that, you know, graduated a long time ago and haven't really kept up with times or kept up with their clinical reasoning, and that's fine. Like, they're still really, really good PTs. But I think that the ability to broaden your scope if you are trained appropriately, I think that should be on the table in some way, shape, or form.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
Das, Micah, you mentioned something earlier that kind of stuck with me. You said something about I think it was one of your patients where they were just stuck mentally with this idea of a bulging disc. Mm-hmm. Can you, I guess, kind of explain what you've seen with the mental side of pain and how that relates? Like, so your mental health and pain, is there a correlation? Mm-hmm. And what you've done to maybe help someone through that?
Yeah. So the nice thing, and I don't want to, I'm trying hard not to be the military guy on a podcast that always talks about the military. So if I'm doing that, I'm sorry.
You're also a CrossFitter too, aren't you?
I'm not a CrossFitter, I promise. But I am the guy on the podcast that does jiu-jitsu, and I haven't brought up that once yet. So, the nice thing about the medical record system that we use is that we see everything. And so if you, we see medical or mental health records, we see immunization records, we see if you went to the optometrist, like when we go and do a document check, we can see it all. And I used to, when I first got in the military, I was told, like, don't click into the mental health records. And then I had a provider saying, well, you're their clinician, right? So when they're in your office, you're their doctor. I was like, yeah. It's like, okay, are you treating an injury or are you treating a person? You're treating the person. So why wouldn't you want to know what they're going through? That is relevant past medical history of whatever care that they're getting. And it's not being snoopy. It's not saying, like, what are they in therapy for or something like that. But we learn about pain that a lot of stuff can affect it. Like, pain is not always a tissue injury. And one of the things that I wasn't a true believer in before I joined, and now looking at thousands of patient records now, is if you are in pain for long enough, and it's a chicken or the egg scenario, but if you're in pain for long enough, that's going to have a mental effect. Or if you are in depression, anxiety for long enough, that's going to lower your pain threshold to where maybe something that you wouldn't normally think is painful is going to start acting as painful. And so I first started noticing it, and I'm not the one that created this or found this at all, but chronic low back pain. I mean, that's what, Cam, 60% of your practice probably on the outside is people with chronic low back pain?
At least.
Yeah. And it's super, super rampant. But most of the time on the outside, the PT just sees back pain. They don't see whatever else the patient's going through unless they really get to know them and have great bedside manner and they open up. And then you're like, oh, I'm going through a divorce or I'm going through financial difficulty or something. Well, we can see that. And so sometimes, you know, I had one the other day where like what they're telling me physically doesn't really make sense. And then I know that they were in counseling and I'm able to ask them like, okay, how are you doing mentally? And they were going through a really, really hard time and getting to explain like some pain science of, sometimes mental pain has a physical outlet, or sometimes if you're in pain for long enough, that's going to sensitize you and you can have that, kind of feed into some depression, anxiety.
Yeah.
But I would say if you put a chronic low back pain patient on my schedule and I looked into their record, you probably got a 70% chance. And I'm making these numbers up, right? But of in the last year, they've seen some sort of counseling. They're on some sort of antidepressant or anti-anxiety med, something to that effect, or they're going through a hard time. And so I don't think as a profession or as health and wellness professionals, we're super tied in to
treating the whole person.
Yeah. Treating the whole person because we don't have that lens. And if you just ask blind, maybe you don't have that rapport with a patient, but if you explain like, hey, I did a chart review on you and I can see you saw Dr. So-and-so in the mental health clinic. How are you doing? And they open up a little bit and then you have a really good window into being able to talk about pain. But I've also seen it help the reverse of, hey, if we treat your physical pain and we give you some control over that, that could have some upstream effects to help you with your recovery mentally. Mm-hmm. Or, hey, sounds like you're going through some depression and anxiety. I know your problem or what you're worried about is that your back is killing you. But maybe if you go talk to this guy and we start working through what's going on between the ears, maybe your back pain's actually going to get better. And I've seen it work both ways.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're, and it seems like y'all's audience is like, you know, dudes in their late 20s, early 30s that are trying to be fit, that are young professionals or dads, or they're busy. Like, and we like to suck up and kind of push our feelings down as low as we possibly can as guys. A lot of us do. But that can have physical manifestations too. To be aware of that. And maybe that's not counseling. Maybe that's I'm going to go in the garage and I'm going to go fix something that doesn't necessarily need to be fixed, or learning what your coping mechanism is. But,
yeah,
it's just something that I've seen and something that I think that it was a surprise to me.
Yeah. Now that you say that too, and it can be obviously clinical depression, clinical anxiety, or just not even diagnosed, whether it's clinical or not. I would venture to say that, like you're saying, at least 60, 70, 80% of people, at least on their intake form, when talking about past medical history or current medical history, will mark depression. And not all of them are taking, you know, SSRs or stuff like that for their anxiety or depression and stuff like that, but they've marked it. So at least how they're feeling, at least internally, whether it's chemical or not, they feel in that state. And that's obviously going to affect their outlook on pain. Because we do know that there's studies, and one of the big things, one of the big factors if someone's going to get better or not is if they believe they're going to get better. Like it's going to affect their outcomes in a positive way. And you've treated patients, I've treated patients that they're Debbie Downer, you know, they don't know why they're there. They're not going to get better. You're like, this could be an easy fix. It's like, this is musculoskeletal. This is right at my alley. You give me 4 weeks, we're going to get you better. They just don't believe it's going to get better. mm-hmm. and they don't. So yeah. there's something to that, and it's cool that you get to access those charts and get to see all of those things that a lot of civilian PTs, we just don't have access to unless the patient pulls up their phone. It's like, here's my MRI result, or, mm-hmm. you know, shows us, pulls up their my chart from their hospital or whatever. Yep. But that takes time, and you know, time is of the essence when you're treating this person and you only get yep. so much time with them.
Yeah, for sure.
So, another thing I want to talk to you about, I know we're winding down here, is this bridging the gap. You said earlier that, you know, not everyone in the PT is a GI Joe looking figure, mm-hmm. and not everybody's fit. There's obesity in the military. So what do you think about, and how for like you as a PT, about bridging that gap between like strength and conditioning and rehab? And what does that look like for kind of clinicians or PTs?
Yeah. So I think, and I see this in like my mom's generation of PTs, or maybe not the people that taught us in school, but maybe the people that taught them, that one of the things that in the rehab profession that we're not good at is, okay, you got them off the table. Now let's do something real. You know, I mean, there's still a lot of PT clinics out there that don't have a squat rack in their clinic, or they don't have a kettlebell, that they have bands and they have multicolored rainbow dumbbells and they have a staircase. Whoever's making that staircase, it's in every clinic. They hit the freaking jackpot. And so then you, all right, you are healed. We're going to discharge you. And then they go back and they try to move a couch and they throw their back out again, because you're not preparing them for the real world. And so, I mean, and honestly, we're not really taught in school how to do that. And then our strength and conditioning brethren aren't really taught how to work around injuries, or what if the bottom of your scale is too much for someone?
Yeah.
You know, if you want to get someone to barbell squat, but they're not there yet, you can scale it down a lot. But at a certain point, it's like, are we even working on the same thing or not?
Yeah.
And so there is a disconnect.
Do you think PTs need more schooling on that? Because I know at least for us, we had two semesters of like exercise, therapeutic exercise or exercise science or whatever. I mean, obviously most PTs get an undergrad in exercise science, but I definitely know what you're saying, where there are some who just don't have a fitness background or have a fitness knowledge base to apply these things, or even know what form looks like. Like how many therapists are good at biomechanics, but they, when it comes to just showing somebody how to front squat, they're like, well, I don't know how to front squat, and I've never been taught. Yeah, I don't know how to do this.
Yeah. I don't know if it's an education thing. I think, and you see it with surgeons too, where they don't want to push it because they don't want to jeopardize what they just did. Like, hey, I just did this surgery. Don't follow my protocol. I don't want you to push it because I don't want you to re-tear. And PTs do that too, of, I just spent 6 weeks babying this person and trying to calm their pain down and trying to build a rapport with them. I don't want to push them too far because they're not going to have a good outcome. And I want to discharge them on a good outcome. But also, that's kind of doing a disservice. And so I don't know what the fix is. I don't know if it's education, but what I do know, and what I'm seeing, and what's very stark to see in the military, is that like fit people don't break as often. And we didn't have this chronic pain problem 40 years ago, 50 years ago. On our Africa rotation, we saw people with injuries that would debilitate somebody at stateside, and they had a smile on their face and they're doing a manual labor job. They have a baseline level of fitness that Americans don't have. And what I'm seeing from other branches, the Marine Corps, the Army specifically, is fitness is a part of their culture. It's part of their job. It doesn't matter if they're an accountant or a cook. If you're in the Army, for the most part, you're up at 6:30 in the morning and you're working out, and then you're expected to be in the office by 9. That's kind of the culture. And so even if they get injured, even if their injury is fairly severe, they're going to recover faster. A lot of times their pain is less. And they're able to operate at a functional capacity that is, that is higher than if they weren't fit in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the Air Force, we don't have that culture of fitness. It's not built into our duty day. And so when someone gets hurt, they go down hard and we have to rebuild them. And so I think that PTs need to be a little bit more humble in that, hey, if you don't know, I would love if outpatient ortho clinics had a strength conditioning coach on staff, even for your geriatric population. Like, to me, that's a responsible handoff to the real world of, all right, I've put Humpty Dumpty back together again. But if I just tell you that you're fine, I'm being disingenuous. And so what the military is starting to do, we're probably the number one employer of CSCSs in the country now, certified strength and conditioning coaches. Doesn't matter if you're a contractor or if you're a GS federal employee, I guarantee we're hiring, the military's hiring more strength and conditioning coaches now than the NCAA.
Wow.
I just hired mine last year, and he was a contractor with the Army, and now he's a GS-12, which for people that know the GS system, that's pretty freaking good, especially for strength and conditioning coaches that historically, you know, if you're in the collegiate setting, you're going to be an unpaid graduate assistant for a couple years, or you might not make a whole lot of money, or maybe you're trying to do your own practice or your own, you know, own business type of thing. And so the Army's kind of leading the way on that.
That's cool.
But we're trying to catch up. And so if you don't know how to ramp someone up into fitness, give them to someone that does, that is more comfortable with that. And then strength coaches, also having the humility to work together, because not always is the person that goes to PT school going to be the same person that's going to be interested in fitness, like high level fitness. Sometimes they are, but sometimes they're not. But for the most part, everyone that's a strength and conditioning coach, that's somewhere in their history, that's somewhere in their background. And so I think they need to work together a little bit, a little bit better, but, yeah, man, a little bit of humility, but also like valuing strength and conditioning coaches a little bit more and finding ways to make them more accessible. Because for your average person, if you're not in the military and you're not in athletics, then you're not, and nothing against personal trainers, but if you have a touch point with a fitness professional, they're probably a personal trainer and they're probably more aesthetically focused, but, and that's some generalizations, but strong people just get strong. Like, we don't load people enough. We don't load people aggressive enough. And I think we should lean more towards being aggressive than being passive with our patients.
Oh, that makes sense. So I guess, Micah, how would you get someone moving pain-free then? Like, what are your recommendations?
Give us three. Oh, goodness. I have to go to my notes. Okay, so I'm a big guy, and big guys don't like cardio. But there's really good studies, and there's really good just anecdotal stuff as far as, like, if cardio is a consistent part of your day, and it doesn't matter what form it's in, it's going to have pain benefits. I don't know where I got this stat from. Someone told me along the way that there had been a study. I could not quote it to you, but I tell it to my patients, and maybe it's disingenuous, but 20 minutes of intense cardio is the equivalent of 800 milligrams of ibuprofen. It's probably not true, but patients love it and they eat it up.
Get that placebo pill, baby.
Exactly. If someone can tear a patient down by telling them that they have degenerative disc disease, I can build them up by being a little bit.
I love it.
Yeah. But adding cardio and making it consistent cardio, finding a format that you can do consistently. When we're talking about pain-free, like find a cardio that is pain-free and do it consistently.
Does the intensity matter? Or is it just low, moderate, high?
Not at the beginning. I mean, my strength and conditioning background is not to the extent of my strength coach. And I'm sure that we don't want to just go out for a walk, like at the end of the day, walking our dogs. Like, let's put the dogs away when we work out. I'm trying to tell that to my wife.
Listen, send her to us.
Yeah. But find some cardio that you can do. And you can scale cardio down enough to where you can find a format where you can get to at least a moderate intensity. I hate running. I run now, and it's probably the best thing for me. Doing stuff that's different, that adds a little bit. I'm not a big stretching guy. I subscribe to the Woody Harrelson Zombieland quote of, you ever seen a lion limber up before it chased a gazelle? But doing something that requires some athleticism, because no one wants to be the guy that when you try to go play basketball with your son blows their Achilles, right? And so
it happens.
For me, that's jujitsu. I'm not going to be, again, the guy that's going to evangelize about jujitsu on a podcast, but finding something that requires some agility, and isn't, I don't know, is a use it or lose it type of thing when it comes to range of motion, when it comes to agility. So finding something different and not just going to the gym and doing the same routine for 20 years. Who wants to do that? And just, I'm going to do a little plug for rucking because the civilian population does not ruck. Are y'all familiar with rucking?
Oh yeah. Go ruck.
Okay. Rucking is great, especially if you're a big dude that hates cardio. Pick something heavy, put it on your back and go for a walk and call it cardio. Like that's awesome. I would encourage people, you know, people are very, they love to do Murph. They love to do memorial wads and stuff like that. Do the Bataan Death March with us. I believe it's in every March. I think it's in March. It's 28 miles with 30 pounds on your back. And in memory of the people that died in the Bataan Death March in World War II. But it's a great workout. I mean, it's steady state cardio, but it's intense and it's fun.
How long does that take you?
Bataan took, I don't want to, this could be completely wrong. I want to say it took like 9 hours.
Okay.
And then the Norwegian ruck march, no, not Norwegian. We did the Danish ruck march when we were deployed, and that was shorter distance, but more weight. And I think that was like 16 miles with 35 or 40 pounds. And that was like 4.5 hours for the cutoff.
Gotcha.
And then you're broken afterwards. So you don't have to do something like that. But like when in doubt, if you don't like running, put something heavy in your backpack, put a podcast on and go for a walk.
You can ruck and mow the lawn.
You can ruck and mow the lawn. If you're a dad, strap the baby in the front and then put the ruck in the back and go for a walk, you know? And then
you'll be doing that soon, man.
I will. But I think the biggest pain-free thing, man, is like weight management, to be honest with you. We don't like to talk about it, like especially as dudes, like, ah, dad bod. We're going to kind of glorify the dad bod a lot. And I'm not trying to give anybody a complex, but my weight fluctuates like crazy. And my pain is lower when I'm below 240. And so we know studies are showing, like, as far as longevity, and especially if we're here to be, you know, better men, live healthier lives, be there for our kids and stuff like that, like, get your weight under control. It is your duty. I think it's your duty as a man, it's your duty as a father. I'm not one yet, so maybe I'm out of my lane a little bit, but be conscious about the body that your creator gave you. Take care of it. And take a little bit of ownership of it, not to be the guy that quotes Jocko on a podcast, but get your weight under control and your pain's going to be better. It might not fix it, but it's a place in the right direction.
Yeah.
That's good. So cardio, do something that's athletic / agility, range of motion, and then three guys, make sure you get your weight under control.
Yeah. You don't have to be a model. Just have it under control.
So why do you think, this is not a question that I sent you, and this is the fun surprise at the end before the rapid fire. Why do you think that some people can make that long-term change and like change their life and get their weight under control and, you know, make that switch, and others can't? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think that if you want to work out or lose weight for aesthetics, or not that aesthetics is bad, like I want to look good naked too, as much as the next guy. But I don't think that is a sustainable motivation.
Is that why not big enough? Like their why?
I don't think it is. And I was thinking about this the other day when I was thinking about like when I was doing rotations through acute rotations, like there are some people, and we'll see our patients of it too, that will put almost no effort into staying alive. Like they, if it's not in a pill form or a surgery form or done for them, they will put very little effort into staying alive. And I think if we look at fitness, yeah, the scale is important, but more than the scale. But if we look into it as, hey, I need to stay alive longer so I can take care of my family, or so I'm not in a nursing home when I'm 80. We look at fitness as medicine a little bit more, or weight management as medicine. I think that should be our motivation. Now we can take it too far. You know, like you're not a good dad if you're necessarily working out 6 hours a day after work and you never see your kid, or right. If you let CrossFit be your entire personality or something like that. So, I mean, yeah, we're going to do everything in moderation, but like you need your motivation to be a little bit more long-term than I'm going to Cabo I want to have a sick Instagram photo.
Right.
So yes, maybe like some more internal motivation instead of relying or being so reliant on that external factor.
Yeah. Cause eventually you'll be like, it's good enough. I'm funny. I don't need to be skinny. Or
she likes my personality.
Yeah, she likes me for my personality or something like that. But if it's like, no, I want to be healthy, and I think people that have seen people that didn't take care of themselves at the end, maybe that's more visceral for them, but like you have a lot of control over the health in the last 3 decades of your life, in the first 4 decades of your life, you know?
Yeah, no, that makes total sense, man. Good answer. Okay. We got fun rapid fire questions.
Hit him with those questions, Cam.
You got as quick as you can. You got to answer as fast as you can. There's a handful of them here. Okay. Ready? And then we'll wrap it up.
Okay.
Air Force or Space Force? Who wins?
In a fight?
Yeah.
Air Force.
Okay. Machines or dumbbells?
Dumbbells.
Upper body or lower body?
Lower body.
Push-ups or pull-ups?
Pull-ups.
CrossFit, yay or nay?
Yeah.
Long runs or sprints?
Long runs. I've seen too many blown Achilles in the last week from sprints.
Okay. Those are it, man.
Okay.
We're tracking people's answers with those. We think they're fun.
Yeah.
But Major Dr. Micah, thank you so much for being on, man. Loved a lot of your answers. Loved just the conversation we had. I think our listeners will get a lot of benefit out of this, and we'll definitely have to have you on in the future. Is there anything you want to let the listeners know before we wrap it up?
Yeah, if anyone has any questions or wants to talk to me, don't slide to my DMs. Don't. No, I'm joking. But if you are interested in either. If you're a strength and conditioning person and you're like, how do I get in with the military? It's a good gig and you're desperately needed. Or if you're interested in service in some way, either in civilian or the military capacity, like, we need you. Like we need people. We need good people with the right mindset. And so, look on GovJobs, GOV jobs. Like, there are listings all over the world for health and fitness professionals that pay good, that the check's going to clear, and that you're going to be helping a lot of people. So
we'll link your username on Instagram down in the description of the podcast. That way, if people need to find you, they can.
Cool. I'll throw my Cash App in there too. So
we'll see.
Well, Micah, thank you so much for coming on. And everyone, just like we like telling you, remember, you're human. You should not seek perfection, but daily improvement. See you guys.
All right. See you guys.